Padre Michael.
Thank you.
Once more, since you've asked me him, of course, as you know, last time I introduced him, he's one outstanding teacher of all of ACU. Now he's also an outstanding contribution to mission.
Something like that.
So I thought I'd had it on the but privileged to be there to celebrate, and it was a great celebration.
Thank you, Mari. I'm going to be recording today's session, and I have a website which is on the board there. The recording will go up onto that website, so you'll be able to listen to your own voice and anything else that's said up there. So, passing around a sheet for you to put your name on.
I've got to sit
so that I can make it legible, so I can read your name, so I can tell who's conversing. And while that's going around, just a quick word from each of you, who you are and what you know about Rilke, like in two or three sentences, whether Rilke is completely new to you or whether you've read Rilke for a while, and maybe why Rilke is important to you, just very briefly.
And just before you do,
yep.
Do you mind using the microphone so that everybody hears?
So we've moved the microphone round to Michael over here. It is Michael, isn't it?
John.
My name is John Conlon. I've been doing quite some research before, and I've been to Michael's book before. I agree with you.
Thank you.
Outstanding teacher.
And Rilke?
And Rilke, I did one of, I think you've done two Rilkes. I only did the first one, I was away from.
I think I've only done one so far.
Okay, well, yeah. I did that.
Good.
I first heard of Rilke through Michael Wheelman and take him on further with you.
Thank you.
My name's Catherine Hamlin, and I've had a long association with Aquinas Academy, and I'll be lecturing another course this coming year, and I don't know anything about it.
Right, okay,
so
good.
I'm looking forward to it, Michael.
Thank you, good.
My name's Margaret White. I know absolutely nothing about Ricky, and I've done no research, but it's always a pleasure to go into it.
Okay. Thank you.
And my name is Walter Hamilton. I probably heard the name Rilke first in my undergraduate year at Sydney University, and I suspect that Michael was probably the source of that naming. I have one volume, I think the modern library edition of some of Rilke's poems, which I have read through, and I had enjoyed reading them, so I thought this would be an opportunity to learn a lot more about it. Thank you.
My name is Anne. This is the first opportunity I've had this year to do a course here, so I would have come to whatever. I know absolutely nothing.
Okay.
My name is Laurie. I have done a couple of courses before here, but know nothing about it.
Okay.
My name is Francis Doherty, and I guess you'd call me a rusted on Aquinas attendee, and I'm very pleased to be here again for this course. Thank you.
Theda, I know of Rilke, but I have never done a course on him.
Okay.
Margaret, a little familiarity, just come across some of his poems, and really have been impressed with the depth and wisdom in them. So looking forward to it.
My name is Heather Proctor. My first visit to Aquinas, though I know all. And I don't know much about Rilke. I met him through Gwen Harwood, of whom I'm a great fan. And also, I know Michael Proctor as he lectured me in the Masters.
My name's Jared, and I don't know anything.
Good.
I'm Sister Mary Beres. I'm a Maris sister, so I have quite a long association with the Aquinas and the Maris. And I have read some of the Rilke poems over the years and I've always really interested in them. And I thought this is a way to really get into the legends and see what, you know, the great depth it's there.
G'day, my name is Leonard Blahood. I'm from the Blue Mountains. When I first saw the name, I thought it was a woman. That's about as far as it went. Then my wife was a few problems. That's my only exposure to this gentleman.
Well, my first encounter, my name is Carol Theodore, and my first encounter with Rilke was, we moved to a farm. I had just had my fourth child in 5 years, and I found this book. It was from a used bookstore on the Book of Hours, and it was from the copyright of 1941. And I loved whatever I read. I really loved it. And I found another translation by Joanna Massey. And I was offended because she didn't speak the same voice that the first one I had. But now I'm reading hers, and it's much more poetic.
I'm Rose Griffith, and I know nothing about real care, but I enjoyed the other two courses that you just might have been in the book. I'm delighted to be there today, and thankfully I was there with the first Rilke,
right,
and was looking forward to the dinner.
Okay, good. Well, thank you all. As I suspected, there's a mix of a few people who went to the first Rilke session and a lot of you who either have had not had any contact with Rilke or very minimally. So I have to kind of play a kind of a game here of satisfying those that went to the first Rilke course, making sure that we do get into the elegies, and giving enough groundwork for those of you who are new to Rilke to find your feet in his work. And my broad plan is to begin with a few of the simpler poems from the early period, to look at a few little selections from the letters that he wrote to a young poet, which have become world famous because of their advice about writing and about what writing means to the inner life. And then I'm actually going to plunge in to the end. I'm going to go to the sonnets to Orpheus to have a look at a few of the sonnets to Orpheus, and then move back to the ninth elegy. Because last time we did the first elegy, the ninth elegy is really quite difficult. And my plan is, my hope at least today, is to work intensively on the early poems, look at some of those letters, and begin to touch the sonnets to Orpheus, and maybe at least read the ninth elegy and tell you where to look for some material on that, so that next week we can move into the ninth elegy. And then we might move back to the first elegy again, because it is such a summative work, and connect that with the sonnets. And then we might move back into some of the early work, particularly the Neue Gedichte, because I think anybody who hasn't had contact with Rilke needs to know about the Neue Gedichte, which are his sing poems, which he wrote under the influence of working with Rodin, the sculptor. So I hope that everybody will be satisfied. None of you will be too traumatized by the difficulty. Rilke is a difficult poet. Now, my connection with Rilke, I'm a native German speaker. I can say that proudly. My mother spoke German to me for the first 6 years of my life. She was an Austrian who had been picked up by an English soldier, carried to England very reluctantly, and then meandered back to Austria frequently. And my grandparents came from Graz, which is about 200 kilometres, maybe 300 kilometres south of Prague, where Rilke was born. And Rilke was born in the German-speaking part of Czechoslovakia. He was proudly German, but he was also very keen on kind of exploring his Slavic roots. And that's part of the whole story of his life. When I was at university, I also fell in love with the Book of Hours and the early religious work. There was something really hauntingly inner, like a man really seeking some kind of depth for his own inner life, connection with the world around him. I found that very appealing. I remember sitting in the bottom of Fisher Library, reading and reading and poring over the original German and feeling that I was in touch with some, you know, some force worth knowing. I studied German at university, but I never really studied Rilke. I cannot claim to be an expert on Rilke. My field is English literature. I can see how Rilke fits into the early 20th century. T.S. Eliot, Gerard Manley Hopkins, W.B. Yeats, he sits right in the middle of that period, a poet who, just after Nietzsche, God is dead, is trying to find the sources of his inner life, some security, some certainty, filled with doubt, ultimately finding his way towards an affirmation, not in the Duino Elegies, but in the sonnets to Orpheus. Orpheus, the mythic figure Orpheus, the poet, the singer, who through his music brings inanimate world to life, became for Rilke the kind of resounding expression of his found spirituality. Now, people will say it's very Christocentric because it's all about dying to yourself. But Rilke's religious position is fascinating because he was brought up by a very rigid Catholic mother. In a household, the father was not very religious. The father wanted nothing to do with his son's poetry. The mother really encouraged Rilke's artistic side, but also dragged him to church. And when he left home, he really rejected Christianity holus bolus. One of his first major collections was called Visions of Jesus, in which he really kind of tore the conventional view of religion of Jesus to pieces, very much like William Blake. When I read about Rilke's attitude to Jesus and some of the poems there, it's very like William Blake's Everlasting Gospel, where William Blake depicts Jesus as born out of wedlock, really very intentionally subversive of Catholic mythology about Jesus and the virgin birth and so on. Rilke was very similar. But Rilke had a curious personal life which some people will find offensive, difficult to deal with. How can you kind of relate that to his own growing spirituality? At the age of 21, he had written one of his poems about Jesus, Jesus the Jew. And through a friend, he was introduced to one of the great intellectual women of the time, Lou Andrea Salome, who was in fact a partner of Nietzsche's. And Andrea Salome was 34 years old, Rilke was 21. But she was on her own spiritual search. She had found, she'd worked with Nietzsche. It's not known whether she was his lover, but it's quite possible. Later, she was a close associate of Freud. She'd written a number of books about psychology. She was on the cusp of the psychology movement at that time. And she fell, and Rilke fell deeply in love with each other, and they formed a partnership for about 3 or 4 years. And she was from North Germany, but she had family in St. Petersburg, and she took Rilke through Russia. And this was a wonderful opportunity for Rilke to make connections with his Slavic side, but also be introduced to Russian monasticism. And some of his early poetry kind of draws on that connection with Russia. And she also drew from Rilke a different kind of spirituality. She drew him away from that negative reaction to Christianity. And it's really fascinating to see how in the Duino Elegies and the Sonnets to Orpheus, he really returns to a deep, more grounded spirituality, which some would argue is very Christocentric. Now, after leaving Lou Andrea Salome, Rilke married an artist, Clara Westhoff, in an artist community in North Germany. They had a daughter, but Rilke was desperate always for his own solitude. He needed relationships, but he needed solitude. And a few years after his daughter was born, he left his wife, left his daughter, and went to Paris and got a job there eventually after a lot of hardship, working with Rodin, the sculptor, as Rodin's secretary. And that was an amazing relationship. Rilke learnt through Rodin how to see, and he moved away from his kind of metaphysical poetry to an intentional looking and seeing what is there, bringing his full attention to detail. And it's also very mystical in its intensity. So there was that early mysticism, then there was that period with Rodin, the Dingedichte, looking at things, looking into the heart of things. His most famous poem, perhaps, of that is the Panther. Might read the Panther while we're just here. We won't be looking at it this morning, but it's worth connecting with it. It's on page 15. I'll read the English version first and then the German. The poem, the English version, is on page 16. His gaze against the sweeping of the bars has grown so weary it can hold no more. To him there seemed to be 1,000 bars, and back behind those 1,000 bars, no world. The soft, the supple step and sturdy pace that in the smallest of all circles turns, moves like a dance of strength around a core in which a mighty will is standing stunned. Only at times the pupil's curtain slides up soundlessly. An image then enters then, goes through the tension, stillness of the limbs, and in the heart ceases to be. Now, translations to my ear are always fraught with complexities. That's why I like to hear the original and then help you to understand the original. Because, of course, Rilke is most famous for his cadences, his rhythm, his sound patterning, all those things that are so untranslatable. In an English translation, you get the kind of the core meaning, perhaps, but the other elements are not so available. Sein Blick ist vom Vorübergehen der Stäbe so müd geworden, dass nichts mehr hält. Ihm ist, als ob es 1,000 Stäbe gäbe und hinter 1,000 Stäben keine Welt. Der weiche Gang, geschmiedig starker Schritte, der sich im allerkleinsten Kreise dreht, ist wie ein Tanz von Kraft um eine Mitte, in der betäubt ein großer Wille steht. Nur manchmal schiebt der Vorhang der Pupille sich lautlos auf. Dann geht ein Bild hinein, geht durch der Glieder angespannte Stille und hört im Herzen auf zu sein. So a rough prose translation of that. Sein Blick, his vision, ist vom Vorübergehen der Stäbe, is because of its continual passing by the rods of the cage, has become so tired that his vision doesn't hold any images anymore, dass nichts mehr hält. Ihm ist, als ob es 1,000 Stäbe gäbe. For him, it's as if there are thousands of stakes. Und hinter 1,000 Stäbe keine Welt. And behind those stakes, no world. Der weiche Gang, geschmiedig starke Schritte. The soft tread, felt like tread of strong steps. Der sich im allerkleinsten Kreise dreht. Which are turning in ever-decreasing circles, ist wie ein Tanz von Kraft um eine Mitte. It's like a dance around an incredible energy in the middle, in der betäubt ein großer Wille steht, in which at the center there is a willpower that is completely deadened, mute. Nur manchmal schiebt der Vorhang der Pupille sich lautlos auf. Only occasionally the eyelid opens silently over his pupils. Dann geht ein Bild hinein, then a picture fleetingly enters. Geht durch der Glieder angespannte Stille und hört im Herzen auf zu sein. The image goes through his limbs, which are there in a receptive stillness, and the image then suddenly stops dead in his heart. That's it. So those are the sorts of poems that Rilke wrote with Rodin, and there's many. The one underneath there, the archaic torso of Apollo, is just amazing. But we will come back to those later on. So while I've got this document open, there at the top, I've said here that Rilke is an extraordinary 20th century poet whose life and work attracts people from all faith traditions in search of understanding the nature of sacred experience and the place of creative language in that search. I gave a seminar here earlier this year on Francis Webb, and with Francis Webb, one of the kind of keynotes of Francis Webb's whole search through his poetry was, in his own words, for the bedrock of reality. Webb, through his image making, through his language, was profoundly in search of the bedrock of reality, his own inner truth. He was often accused of being obscure and evasive, but he argued very solemnly that his creative effort, his languaging capacity, was there to find a connection with his own inner truth. Now, Rilke has been called a realist or a naturalist of one's inner intimate sensations. And I think you capture something of that in what he's describing about the panther. He's kind of projecting some of his own inner experiences into that world of the panther, the kind of stuckness, the incredible energy, the need for expression. Lou Andrea Salome, who I spoke about earlier, she was, through her psychology, she was very interested in this whole idea of making souls, of how living in the world, living in a certain way, would create the soul. That we have the capacity to, in a sense, create God in us. And I was just reading John Mayne this morning, a passage there, which spoke exactly about, you know, meditative path as creating a soul within the self. So there's so many kind of interlinking linkages here. In this introduction in your booklet here on page 2, I talk here about the ninth elegy, which we're going to move to before not too long. And to look at the second stanza in the English version there at the top of page 2. Why, if it could begin as laurel and be spent so, this space of being, a little darker than all the surrounding green, why then have to be human? Because being here is much, and because all that's here seems to need us. Now, it's a very inscrutable little passage if you just come at it like this, out of the context of the whole poem. The German, warum, wenn es angeht, also die Frist des Daseins hinzubringen als Lorbeer, ein wenig dunkler als alles andere grün, weil hier sein viel ist und weil uns scheinbar alles das Hiesige braucht. So, Rilke wrote these lines here in 1912. It is supposed that he wrote the opening lines of the ninth elegy in the Duino Castle at the top of the Adriatic. He would have preferred to be in Capri, but the Adriatic was very cold and stormy. Apparently he walked along the cliffs there, and
Along the cliffs there are a lot of laurel trees, a lot of bay leaves. There's the bay leaf in the bottom left-hand corner. The bay leaf, a little darker than the surrounding green, and it has a kind of a yellow edge to it. And this image came to his mind in the opening part of the sonnet. What would it be to be like a laurel leaf? Surely a laurel leaf, which is a little darker than all the surrounding green, has a nature, has an aim. It has a purpose. He's kind of reflecting there on life in nature. And he's questioning from that the purpose of being human. And his answer there in these opening lines, and this is not all the opening lines, it's just a selection, because being here is much, and because all that's here seems to need us. So Rilke himself experiences as a human being not the certainty and contentment and containment and thisness of a laurel leaf, but he finds in himself being here is much, and because all that's here seems to need us. So he feels this kind of demand, and that's in a sense where Rilke begins. As an artist, as a poet, he feels this demand for consciousness, ultimately, for consciousness and for expressing that consciousness. Look at the little next paragraph I've got here underneath the opening stanza to the ninth. I'm just summarising what some of us did when we were here at our last Rilke seminar. In his first Duino elegy, Rilke observed that humans are by nature not really at home in our interpreted world. That's a phrase from the first elegy. Not really at home in our interpreted world. The way I read this, and this is what I like about Rilke so much, is that none of us are at home in our interpreted world. We are all distracted from distraction by distraction, as our friend T.S. Eliot told us, and he wasn't wrong. And Rilke, as an artist, feels this deep commitment to leverage himself out of distraction and find connection with what is around him. And believe it or not, it's really strange, but Rilke, who is such a, you know, an iconic poet of the highfalutin, you might say, is ultimately dedicated to the most ordinary, the most simple things around him. Like Francis Webb. You remember from Francis Webb's seminar, to blown straw was given all the fullness of heaven. Francis Webb, in that image, is talking about Jesus in the stable. Blown straw. To blown straw is given all the fullness of heaven. For Webb too, it was the simplest objects that resonated with the richest meaning. And this is what Rilke also tries to get to through his layered language. So Rilke says that we're not really at home in our interpreted world. We're lacking the creative vision to make the connections that could restore our humanity, our being. And I'm saying here in his later elegies, and indeed throughout his creative work, Rilke challenges his readers to make these connections. Okay. Anybody got any questions or comments on what I've raved on about so far? Yep, please. Now, you are, hang on a second. Leonard.
Yes. Whenever you're speaking,
if you just use one of the microphones. I've got one. I've got one here. Thank you.
Yes. Bit of understanding, interpretive world, is he suggesting the interpretive world is a distraction?
No. That's an interesting question. Not really at home in our interpreted world. The German is, let me go to the German, which is on page 25. It's about 10 lines down. Engel nicht, Menschen nicht und die findigen Tiere merken es schon, dass wir nicht sehr verlässlich zu Hause sind in der gedeuteten Welt. That means angels, humans, and reliable animals, the animals of the world, have noticed that we are not very dependable or reliable at home in our interpreted world. Now, I read that. I have read it as a little bit like what Walt Whitman says about dogs. Dogs are beautifully in harmony with their own nature and the world, and human beings are not in harmony with the world around them. So interpreted, as you've thrown me with that question, what does it actually mean, interpreted? Die gedeuteten Welt. Is it the world that should be interpreted, or is it the world that we've misinterpreted around us? So that's a question. No immediate answer. Yeah, go, please. Carol.
Or the world that had been interpreted for us.
Yep, that's right. That's right. We're not very at home with that. Yeah. So he's pointing to something beyond that. Something perhaps that's more true. Yes, Rose?
Is the idea of cultural and expression of what's around, and it changes so much it can't be right.
Yeah, that's good too. Beautiful. Thank you. Any other comments or questions so far? Good. All right, well, I'd like to jump in. I want to look at three of the early poems to kind of give us a taste or a flavour of Rilke's language. And I must admit, having spent considerable time now on the sonnets and on the elegies, when I come back to these early poems, it's amazing how close they are in their tone, their feeling, to what comes later. And that's always amazing. It's the same with Francis Webb. You know, some of the difficult later poems, you go back to the early ones, and the images, the ideas, the yearnings are still there, very palpable. Although here, it's more simply expressed, with less subtlety perhaps. So this first poem on page 3, from Rilke's Book of Hours. So this slide that I've got in is actually a slide that I used in the first seminar in 2014. And just a bit of context there, that's Lou Andrea Salome in the bottom left. She was 34 when she met Rilke at 21. Published several books, European famous intellectual. She took Rilke to Russia, and in Russia he met a peasant poet whose name I can't remember just off the top of my head, but Rilke was kind of deeply impressed by the simplicity, the spirituality of Russia. And for people at that time, Russia seemed to be clean from all the consumerism and industrialization of Western Europe. Russia seemed to kind of hold out a hope. And Lou Andrea Salome even took Rilke to see Tolstoy. They went to visit Tolstoy. So, you know, she had all the connections. She had family there. Rilke was amazingly lucky, really. It was just like the world opened up to him for that. So let's look at this first poem here, from Rilke's early Book of Hours, 1899. Rilke was born in 1975, so he was 24 when he wrote this, around about 24. I'm going to read the German first. Ich finde dich in allen diesen Dingen, denen ich gut und wie ein Bruder bin. Als Samen sonst du dich in den Geringen und in den Großen gibst du groß dich hin. Das ist das wundersame Spiel der Kräfte, dass sie so dienend durch die Dinge gehen, in Wurzeln wachsend, schwinden in die Schäfte und in den Wipfeln wie ein Auferstehen. Now I'm going to give you a prose translation for you off the cuff, and then we look at the English translation by Stephen Mitchell. I find you, it's a book of hours. Remember, it's a book of hours, and typically the book of hours were celebration of the divine force. I find you in all these things, Dingen. Remember that in German, all nouns are capitalized, all nouns, so not a special Dingen. I find you in all these things, in which, or in relation to which, I'm like a brother, and I feel good through that. You sun yourselves in the smallest seeds, and in the great things you give yourself greatly to them. This is the wonderful play of forces, that they serve gratefully to go through all things, growing in roots, disappearing in branches, and in the tops of trees, coming to a resurrection or a revival. Here's Stephen Mitchell's translation. I find you, Lord, in all things and in all my fellow creatures, pulsing with your life. As a tiny seed, you sleep in what is small, and in the vast, you vastly yield yourself. The wondrous game that power plays with things is to move in such submission through the world, groping in roots and growing thick in trunks and in treetops like a rising from the dead. Ich finde dich in alle diesen Dingen, denen ich gut und wie ein Bruder bin. Als Samen sonst du dich in den Geringen und in den Großen gibst du groß dich hin. Das ist das wundersame Spiel der Kräfte, dass sie so dienend durch die Dinge gehen, in Wurzeln wachsend, schwinden in die Schäfte und in den Wipfeln wie ein Auferstehen. Anybody got a response or a sense of what this poem is attempting to communicate, attempting to reach through its language? Do you find you resonate with it, or do you find you don't, or what kind of response do you have? Mari, do you want to say something?
I was thinking of Jared made me hot. Sorry.
Just do what I was saying. I was thinking of the isness of things with Jared made me hot.
Yeah, the inscape.
Yes.
Yeah, very much, yeah. Leonard?
I know a little bit of German, but I don't see the word Lord in the German translation.
No, it's not there.
So why did the English translator assume that?
Well, the opening line is, I find you in all these things, and the you is not specified, and the poem is very much about the life force in everything, tiny and great. So that's a kind of an assumption that would bring Lord into focus. But, you know, you're quite right. I've got this book here, which I picked up last year. William Gass, Reading Rilke, Reflections on the Problems of Translation. And it takes a number of his elegies and a number of his poems and shows that there are 50 different translations of each line, and what those 50 different translations lead to in terms of what the poem is actually expressing. I mean, it's an extraordinary, interesting problem, translation, and how we can kind of come to the essence of what the poem is saying. Because, you know, teaching poetry, one of the first things you do is you tell people that the meaning is not simply in the semantic content. It's in the whole movement, the sounding, the patterning, the cadence, and so on and so forth. So we have some work to do to get to the truth of Rilke.
Well, I guess what I like about it is the sense of his desire, or his recognition of the interwovenness and interconnectedness of himself and nature.
Beautiful.
Which is something I suppose I'm challenged to grow in these days.
That's right.
How the science talks about the interconnectedness of life.
That's right. That's very true. Yep. And Wally?
Michael, I'm not able to get it from the original German, but
yep.
I was wondering, in the second stanza, should we be reading it this way? The wondrous game that that power plays with things. So that power being possible with life in the previous. But when you read it, it seems like power, what does power mean here? But if you read it as that power, you understand it's the power that you refer to. Specific power.
Yeah, that's right. Something beyond just yeah. Well, the German, das ist das wundersame Spiel der Kräfte, that translates literally, this is the wonderful play of forces, of energies, plural. That's how it's translated. So it doesn't have that specificity in it, but the poem begins, ich finde dich in alle diesen Dingen, I find you in all these things. This is the wonderful play of energies. Obviously that energy comes from the dich that he's referring to in the first stanza. So it is focused as far as I read it. Does that connect?
Well, it seems to me the German is focused,
yep.
Whereas the English translation here becomes a little diffuse,
yep.
Because the that here can mean just a connective word.
Yeah.
But does it also mean a specifying that? A particular power, that power. That's the way I read it, but you need two that's really in a prosaic and a prose.
Yeah, you do.
Meaning
that's right.
That
yeah.
So in the poem, you take a shortcut.
That's
and I
right.
I think it kind of cuts your upper blind out a bit.
It does.
Just taking a shortcut.
Good. Nice for you to notice that. And I'm just, yeah, sorry to be personal, but I'm just recalling that Wally and I chatted like this 40 years ago at Sydney University, debating Yeats and Rilke and various things. It just suddenly came back to me. No, I can't remember that. I'm not going to comment. Yes, please, Catherine.
Sorry,
Catherine, is it?
Yes.
Yep.
I was thinking it reminded me a lot of the Alain Vital, of the French philosopher, that movement. And also
Alain Vital, yep.
Yes, and something also in Chardin goes, that same movement.
Okay.
Going towards the omega point. So it has that same thrust of energy.
Yes. I mean, I like especially the last two lines in the German. In Wurzeln wachsen, he's talking here about this innate energy in nature, coming back to Mari's comment about Hopkins. In Wurzeln wachsen, growing in roots, and you've got the, you know, in German you've got this wonderful alliteration and also consonants. In Wurzeln wachsen, schwinden in die Schäfte, growing in the roots, schwinden in die Schäfte, disappearing into the branches and the trunks, schwinden in die Schäfte. You can kind of hear it in the movement of the language. In Wurz and Wurzeln wachsen kind of gives it that sort of earth quality. Wurzeln wachten, schwinden in die Schäfte. You know, there is a real meaning in sound that's part of the whole artistry of poetry. Schwinden in die Schäfte und in den Wipfeln wie ein Auferstehen. And in the very tips, Wipfeln is the very tips of the trees, ein Auferstehen, a resurrection. Auferstehen is, the meaning is resurrection, can be revival, but you know, definite religious connotations in there. In Wurzeln wachsen, schwinden in die Schäfte und in den Wipfeln wie ein Auferstehen. You know, it's just wonderful artistry, the way the words capture together there, the sense of the groundedness of the seeds growing down in the roots, the energies flying up to the trees and then bursting out in the tops of the trees. Wonderful. Reminds me, actually, of that poem by Judith Wright, The Wattle Tree.
Yes.
Remember that one?
Yes.
Yep. Wonderful poem. We did it here some time ago.
It's sort of almost an oxymoron of power and submission, because the elements of power are in groping in roots.
Yep.
Sorry.
Start again, Heather, please.
I was wondering if there was an element of oxymoron between power and submission, because you've got the power groping in roots, and thick, which has an element both of spreading but also density,
yep,
dullness,
yep,
and the tree tops
Absolutely.
So there's a sort of power that's through it all, but isn't blatant and forceful.
No, and it expresses itself in delicate power, movement up to the top. Yeah, beautiful, lovely. Okay, let's turn the page.
Can I say just one thing?
Yep, please, Mary.
The part of the Marvel is for Blake, obviously. The May Magnificat of all things rising, all things rising.
Yep.
No, my memory, I've forgotten the next
yep,
line.
Yep, yep, yep.
Just had that same sort of a feel.
Yeah, that's very interesting, yeah. Well, Hopkins was writing almost contemporary of Rilke, same time, same time. Yep.
It's giving me an appreciation of the young woman that I was, that I read, right. When I first read this, about trying to get out of the culture that had named God for me.
You're right.
You know, so all of these little things that were reflecting, and I was on a farm.
Yep.
So all these things that were reflecting, and my kids reflecting life to
yep,
me,
yep.
had very little words that were the same as what I would go to church to hear.
That's right. You know? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's very interesting. I must admit that that is what attracted me to Rilke to begin with, because, you know, when I started university, I was religiously very uncertain of where I was and what I was doing, having kind of left Catholic boarding school in England and having the Christ literally beaten out of me, and finding Rilke a voice that I could really attune to without all the overlay of religiosity.
Yes.
So yeah, same thing. Very interesting. So over the page 4, from the book of Mönchischen Leben, the life of the monk, or from the monastic life, the book of monkish or monastic life. And there's the cover of that first book. And this was written after his trip to Russia. I'll read the German first. Da neigt sich die Stunde und rührt mich an mit klarem, metallenem Schlag. Mir zittern die Sinne, ich fühle, ich kann, und ich fasse den plastischen Tag. Nichts war noch vollendet, ehe ich es erschaut. Ein jedes Werden stand still. Meine Blicke sind reif, und wie eine Braut kommt jedem das Ding, das er will. Nichts ist mir zu klein, und ich liebe es trotzdem und male es auf goldgrün und groß und halte es hoch und weiß nicht, von wem löst es die Seele los. Oh, that's fantastic. Let me translate it for you. Da neigt sich die Stunde. The hour is inclining towards me. Neigen ist inclined. The hour is inclining towards me und rührt mich an and is affecting my feeling. With klarem metallenem Schlag, with a clear metal sound, ring. Mir zittern die Sinne. My nerves are alive. Ich fühle, ich kann. I feel and I can and I grasp. It's not the plastic day, but it's the day that can be shaped and formed in plastischen Tag. Ich fasse den plastischen Tag. Nichts war noch vollendet, ehe ich es erschaut. Nothing was completed until I took it in, till I lay hold of it with my senses and my eyes. Ein jedes Werden stand still. Everything that was becoming stood still before I was there responding to it. Meine Blicke sind reif. My sight, my vision is ripe. Und wie eine Braut kommt jeden das Ding, das will. And like a bride, everything comes to one in the way that it should, in the way that he wills. Nichts ist mir zu klein. Nothing is too small for me. Und ich liebe es trotzdem, and I love it nevertheless, despite its smallness.
und males auf goldgrund und groß. And I paint it on a golden background and large. Und halte es hoch and hold it high und weiß nicht von wem and don't know to whom or for whom löst es die Seele los, it is going to open and loosen their soul. Here's the poetic translation. The hour is turning and touches me. Then sounds clear and metallic its chime. My senses are trembling. I feel that I can, and I grasp that reworkable time. And nothing is finished ere there I abide, and every becoming stands still. My eyes have matured, like winning a bride, each sight wins whichever it will. There's nothing too small that I would not love and paint on gold ground and whole, not knowing from whom, as I lifted above, it is liberating the soul. Da neigt sich die Stunde und rührt mich an mit klarem Metallen im Schlag. Mir zittern die Sinne, ich fühle, ich kann und ich fasse den plastischen Tag. Nichts war noch vollendet, ehe ich es erschaut. Ein jedes Werden stand still. Meine Blicke sind reif und wie eine Braut kommt jedem das Ding, das er will. Nichts ist mir zu klein. Und ich liebe es trotzdem und male es auf Goldgrund und groß und halte es hoch und weiß nicht, von wem löst es die Seele los. This almost comes out of the elegies. He's talking here about being available and open to impressions, shaping them, not being prejudiced to anything that comes within his grasp, giving all his energy and power, making it beautiful as best he can, holding it up in the hope that it's going to liberate somebody's soul. And there it is on the page with its golden background. Anyone like to offer a comment or a thought? Catherine, John. No, John, you were the one.
What did you say for plastician?
Plastician, well, I think it means more like, you know, you talk about clay being malleable is the word I was looking for, malleable. Plastic has got the unfortunate overtones of, you know, modern technology, but it means malleable, shapeable.
The translator uses the word reworkable.
It means, yeah.
But I think the word that comes for the first time, not reworkable, but treating as if it hadn't been worked before.
Yeah, I think that's what I understand it. Ich fasse den plastischen Tag. I grasp the malleable day. The day is full of opportunities and I'm filled with this sense of openness. The clear metal sound of the bell is resonating in me. My being is alive to impressions. My energies are tingling. My nerves are tingling. My consciousness, I'm feeling, I can. It's like the kind of birth of a moment of creation, and I grasp the malleable day. You know, later on in his life, when he was writing the sonnets to Orpheus, he'd finished the Duino elegies, and it's unbelievable, but he wrote 55 sonnets in about 2 weeks, and it came upon him. It was like he actually spoke about it as automatic writing, but it wasn't quite automatic because it was incredibly well formed, well rhymed, well shaped, all sonnet forms, 55 sonnets. And when I read this here, ich fühle, ich kann, ich fasse den plastischen Tag, that's the impression I have of Rilke sometimes in his most creative and energetic moments of life. That was what happened when the Duino elegies came too. When he started writing, before he started writing the Duino elegies, he's in a state of complete despair, hopelessness, closedness, and then suddenly
he was walking on the cliffs above the Duino castle, and this line came to him. Wer hörte mich aus der Engelordnungen? Ein jeder Engel ist schrecklich. And that line opened for him a sudden burst of understanding of where he was, why he was, and where he needed to go, what was wrong with his human condition as it was. And the whole thing was a kind of a, you know, an awakening to his deepest need. I mean, some people have said that, you know, Rilke was grounding a religion through his vision. I suppose that's how visions happen. You get a human being who's got, through the circumstances of their life, they come to that moment where they just tune in to what human beings need and how they are in relation to the cosmos. And there it is for us to connect with as best we can. Ich fasse den plastischen Tag. Any other comments about this poem? Yes, Wally. Do you mind me calling you Wally, or do you prefer Walter?
That's fine.
That's fine. Good.
Sort of stopping in the last stanza with this ungrosse and whole, it's kind of it's a numb kind of word. It doesn't.
Gross is a numb word.
It doesn't convey a specific idea.
Yeah.
Whole, complete. What does whole mean here? And it takes me back to the piece on page 2.
Yeah.
Translated. It's around talking about the laurel leaf.
Oh yeah,
and then the translation means, because being here is much. It sounds in English as it rendered there is a kind of almost childlike inability to articulate.
A bit too what? Sorry.
It's an inability to articulate a specific meaning. Because it's very broad, isn't it?
It is very broad.
Because being here is much.
That's right.
Here's, and also here, in this poem, yeah. Also seems to have a kind of a. It's like this poem. Fallen down rather than trying to specify. That's right.
Well, that's a really good observation, and something we can come back to when we look at the sonnets to Orpheus and the Duino elegies, which, you know, I'm going to argue are far more finessed and far more poetically carefully aligned to his inner condition. Maybe that's a good thing to look out for, whether in those poems he doesn't fall into that kind of, what word might you use for it, kind of bathos almost, or a... do you have a word for it, Wally?
Well, it's a kind of stammer.
A stammer. It is like a stammer, that's right. Es unmal ist auf Goldgrund und groß. Yeah.
It's a word that comes out almost without thinking about it.
That's right. That's right. The gold grund, I see, is a kind of mirroring or reflecting his sense of you know, an ancient text with a gold background. He's kind of wanting to aggrandize this momentary sense of openness to impressions, holding it high, almost a sort of a biblical reverential, but maybe lacking some of the enthusiasm and force of the opening stanza, mir zittern die Sinne, ich fühle, ich kann, ich fasse den plastischen Tag. Yes, Carol. Sorry, not Carol, Catherine.
I was going to say, when I read that word gold, I thought of those marvelous icons.
Yeah, that's right.
Here I was in St. Petersburg,
that's right.
The Church of the Spirit of Light. Honestly, it's just so striking, that gold background of all of those paintings, and I could picture what he was thinking of.
Yeah.
Must have been impressed by that.
Sorry?
I just agree.
You agree. Okay. We're going to have a break in a minute, but I just wanted to just leave you with a couple of things ringing in your ears. If you go to the bottom of page 6, now these are from Rilke's Letters to a Young Poet. If you don't know the Letters to a Young Poet, then if you really get interested in Rilke, the Letters to a Young Poet are a great place to start. Because, first of all, in the English translation, you don't miss the loss of poetry, because it's prose, and prose is, you know, much easier to translate into another language. And you do get in it a flavour of the sorts of things that really gave us a clue to what animated Rilke's soul and passion. So, bottom of page 6, from letter 5, he's here describing being in Rome. And he's made some comments here about Roman archaeology and various things. And the bottom of the page, the last two words, waters unendingly full of life, moving over to page 7, waters unendingly full of life move along the old aqueducts into the great city and dance in the many squares over white stone basins and spread out in wide spacious pools and murmur by day and lift up their murmuring to the night that is large and starry here and soft with winds. And gardens are here, unforgettable avenues and flights of stairs, stairs devised by Michelangelo, stairs that are built after the pattern of downward gliding waters. Through such impressions one collects oneself, wins oneself back again out of the pretentious multiplicity that talks and chatters there, and how talkative it is, and one learns slowly to recognize the very few things in which the eternal endures that one can love, and something solitary in which one can quietly take part. That's wonderful lines. You know, it really kind of attuning us to what is important about taking in impressions of things around us and what kind of impact that has on our own inner state to collect oneself. And this is the agenda of his whole life work. Now, just before we go for a cup of tea, I just want to point out to you how this seminar is organized. On page 19, there is a creative exercise, and this is not a homework, not homework. not homework. What has happened in the last seminars is that there has been this element of creative exercise, not homework, and people have gone away and they've felt inspired in their week to read over what we've done and maybe try one of these creative exercises. And then I've got a folder at home of materials that were brought last time. People do bring things, and it can be read out, it can be shared, and that's really interesting too, because your experience of this work is as important as mine, and what you have to say about it is, you know, a beautiful creative response. It can be part of our whole engagement with Rilke. So I've actually, the second part of that creative exercise relates to what I've just read. The first part you won't be able to do for next week because we're not doing the Neue Gedichte. We looked at the Panther very briefly. So that's just to give you a heads up. So next week or the week after or the week after, if you've got something that you've written, then bring it to me at the start of the seminar and Murray can photocopy it, can you? Yep. And we can spend a little time at the end of the seminar reading and sharing that, if you wish. If you don't have, if you don't want to. I know some people are cringing at that thought. You don't have to do anything. When we come back, we're going to plunge into the sonnets to Orpheus. And I'll tell you a little bit more about those when we get there. But please now relax for 10 minutes, have a cup of coffee or tea, and stretch your legs. Yeah, good.